From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. It's hard to understand how Sunday's murderous attack on Christians in Sri Lanka could have happened. Foreign governments handed the government of Sri Lanka significant intelligence warning of a potential terror strike. They reportedly even had the names of the individual suicide bombers. The country's Muslim community begged the government to root out the extremists in their midst. Instead, we have more than 300 funerals. And now the Islamic State claiming responsibility as well, raising the specter of ISIS, diminished in places such as Syria, but still a deadly force elsewhere. This hour on Point, the Easter Sunday attacks in Sri Lanka. And you can join us. Do you have family in Sri Lanka? Do you fear the attack will create new divisions in that country? And what's your question about the Islamic State's possible involvement and what that means for the fight against ISIS? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Well, we'll begin today first in Colombo, Sri Lanka, the country's capital, with Anusha Ondache. She's a Colombo bureau chief for Bloomberg News. Anusha, thank you so much for joining us today.
Hi there. Yes, hi.
Hi. So first of all, tell us what's the latest that we know about ISIS's claim that it is responsible for Sunday's attacks in Sri Lanka?
Yes, we've just concluded a press conference by the Prime Minister, Mr. Wickremesinghe. And in that he said, yes, Sri Lanka will follow up on these claims by ISIS of its involvement in Sunday's attacks. But he also said that there had already been some suspicions of ISIS's involvement in this. But he was saying that the government is still not fully certain what the global links are to this the terrorist attack, but they keep reiterating that there certainly has to be international help and involvement in all of this.
That there has to be a foreign involvement because of the incredible coordination and scale of the attacks. Is that correct?
Absolutely. A local jihadist, very little known local jihadist group, is hardly going to have been able to make this sort of impact at such a huge scale, such a well-coordinated wave. So they feel, and there'd been intelligence also of these attacks coming in. So they keep pointing to the fact that there's got to be outside involvement, even to the point of the Prime Minister said maybe they went overseas and came back having had some training or fighting experience with IS. So even that sort of thing. But certainly these are not local jihadists working alone.
So can you tell us more about this intelligence that had been coming in to the Sri Lankan government prior to the attack? I mean, I'm seeing here that even the Minister of Telecommunications for Sri Lanka put out a tweet saying intelligence officers were aware of a possible attack, and he put out photographs of a letter that members of the government had received. What happened there?
Yes, so the Prime Minister also admitted that there had been this lapse, and he claimed that this was the first he even heard of such a memo. And today at the press conference, he said there was definitely a breakdown in communication and that the government has to make some changes in its policies and its setup and structures so that they avoid this sort of lapse. Having said that, they've imposed a state of emergency as of yesterday, which gives the military and the police more teeth to do their investigations, to go after the perpetrators. So now all the engines seem to be, you know, fired. But he did admit today again that there were the lapses, there was the miscommunication, and changes have to be made. There was one minister who asked for the head of police to resign. That hasn't happened yet, but as the Prime Minister says, there's likely to be changes made across the spectrum.
So, Anusha, if I may, I'm reading here a translation of a letter that was dated April 11th of 2019 that was sent to the Ministerial Security Division. This is this intelligence that we're talking about here. And it says,
yes,
very explicitly at the top of the letter, information of an alleged planned attack. It says, and in bullet point number two, it says, you are instructed to pay particular attention to the reference made under the National Thawith Jaman concerning a possible suicide attack being planned in this country. And it even gives the names of the potential suicide bombers. I mean, this is explicit intelligence. Did the Prime Minister say any more about why there seemed to be such a spectacular failure if the warning was coming that something was going to happen this month?
Correct. And even they had mentioned on churches, and they had said Indian High Commission, the embassy was not affected, but a lot of these hotel bombings were in the vicinity of the Indian embassy. So the Prime Minister is pointing fingers at the President. You may be aware that they have a very shaky coalition that, you know, collapsed even last year, and it was only thanks to the Supreme Court that the current Prime Minister was able to get back his position. So they've had a very, strained relation. And the Prime Minister has been saying that the President kept him out of all these security issues and knowledge. And so it's a huge crack in all of this that led to such a disaster.
It is very hard to stomach the contents of this letter now, because as we still look through it, as we've been saying, individual suspected attackers are named. The level of intelligence is so detailed that even at one point it says it has been further found that one of the attackers visits his wife and children at night during particular hours. So they even knew when and where these people were moving around in Sri Lanka. It's
correct.
Stunning.
And they have, the ministers after that have admitted that, yes, these are some of the perpetrators. They even said that some of them have been arrested, and some of them were amongst the suicide bombers. Some died in the attack. So they're admitting that the information in that letter is accurate.
So, Anusha Ondache, what are the members of the Sri Lankan Muslim community saying? Because we've also been seeing reports that the Muslim community itself was crying out to the government for help in dealing with potential extremism in the community.
Exactly. And now they're fearing for a backlash against the Muslims, because it could just go across the board. You won't be able to identify one from the other. So these very Muslims who had been making these warnings are now fearful for their own safety, because the 30-year war that Sri Lanka had to endure came out of communal riots. Out of, this is another reason why even now we are on a third day of nightly curfews. First, to keep people off the streets from rioting and all of that. There's not been any of it, I must make clear. Mm-hmm. And it also gives them the military, to try and look for more suspects, perpetrators, guys on the run. But yes, the Muslims now fear for their own safety and the perception of the entire community. Certainly, who aren't all extremists.
Mm. And Anusha, since you mentioned that there's been several nights of curfew as well, what is the mood overall in Sri Lanka? Because I'm seeing here that the Prime Minister is also warning that there could be more explosives and militants out there.
Yes. He denied that he knew of any intelligence of more attacks. But having said that, he says we keep finding these guys on the run, some of whom are carrying explosives with them. And currently there's a high alert amongst the police stations in Colombo to look out for an explosive-laden van or lorry. So that's an ongoing alert. Yesterday, the special task force had to defuse a parcel bomb close by to one of the churches that were already attacked on Sunday. And there were some detonators found, so there seems to be a lot still out there.
Mm. And tell us more about how the Christian community is responding. There are obviously more than 300 funerals going on, some for foreign tourists as well. I mean, is there a lot of concern amongst the community? Is there a lot of security around these events?
Yes, there is a lot of security. And today there was mass burial, especially in the church that was close to the airport in the Nigambo area, where more than 100 devotees, were killed. So today, during one of these mass, they actually had the funeral mass close to the church that was attacked itself. But one of the priests warned that they shouldn't be having such big public gatherings till we know that there's entire safety is assured.
You know, Anusha, this morning we saw a video that the government released that showed one of the alleged bombers entering one of the churches wearing a backpack. And prior to him entering, he stops and what looks like, you know, he pats a child on the head and then walks into the church and subsequently explodes the bomb. I mean, it is chilling to see. And I'm just wondering how this event has really rocked Sri Lanka, because the country had been enjoying almost, you know, roughly a decade of relative peace after a violent civil war. I mean, is there concern that this could destabilize Sri Lanka?
Definitely there is that concern. So it's a very tense atmosphere right now, but I think the government is trying its level best to keep people calm, to assure them of security and of, peace. And today, even in Parliament, the Prime Minister said, more than anything, we have to avoid going back into a war scenario. So certainly there's a worry. There's concerns because the economy also was just about rebounding after last year's political crisis. So now concerns back on the macro, the economic side of it, as well as the security side of it.
Well, Anusha Ondachi, joining us from Colombo, Sri Lanka. She's the Colombo Bureau Chief for Bloomberg News. Anusha, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
We are talking about the latest in what we know as of this broadcast of the coordinated attacks this weekend in Sri Lanka. The Islamic State is claiming responsibility. We also now, as Anusha described to us, have word that there was very significant intelligence available to the Sri Lankan government prior to the attack that the government didn't act upon. So what's your question for what it means that IS or the Islamic State might have been involved in these attacks? What's your question about whether or not Sri Lanka will be destabilized? We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking about the latest in this weekend's Easter Sunday coordinated terrorist bombings in Sri Lanka. Let's listen to what the mayor of Sri Lanka's capital city of Colombo had to say. This is Rosie Senanayake speaking to the Associated Press yesterday, condemning the bombings that killed more than 300 people.
When, you know, innocent people would be worshipping God on an auspicious day such as Easter Sunday, they go seeking, you know, the Lord. And at a time like this, for somebody to come and, you know, destroy humanity, human lives, is a very cowardly attack.
Well, let's listen also to Colombo's Archbishop Malcolm Cardinal Ranjith responding to the attacks. He called upon all Sri Lankans to pray that the injured, the many, many injured, be healed, and that those who lost a loved one be consoled. And then he said this.
I also like to ask the government to hold a very impartial, strong inquiry and find out who is responsible behind this act, and also to punish them mercilessly. And I ask all our Sri Lankan people not to take the law into their own hands and to maintain peace and harmony in this country.
That's Colombo's Archbishop speaking there. And he's asking the government to hold a very impartial, strong inquiry to find out who's responsible. Well, in the past 24 hours, we found out that the government may have known, or there was intelligence, very credible intelligence shared with the Sri Lankan government earlier this month saying an attack was imminent. And now we also have the Islamic State claiming responsibility. Joining me now from Toronto, Canada, is Amarnath Amarasingham. He's a senior research fellow at the Institute for Strategic Dialogue. He's a Sri Lankan and an expert both in Sri Lankan politics and international extremist groups, author of Pain, Pride and Politics, Sri Lankan Tamil Activism in Canada. Amarnath, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us is Zachary Abuza. He's with us from Washington today. He's a professor of national security strategy at the National War College and an expert on terrorism, insurgencies, and more in Southeast and South Asia as well. Zachary Abuza, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
So, Amarnath, can I just begin with you? First of all, tell us what your reaction is to hearing that the Islamic State now is claiming responsibility for Sunday's attacks. How does that change the picture of what we understand of what happened in Sri Lanka?
I mean, I think it was just a matter of time before they claimed it. From the very beginning, the attack seemed a little bizarre given the Sri Lankan context and the kind of choice of targets and who was attacked and the nature of the targets and so on, as well as the kind of sophistication of the operation that was involved. And so from the very beginning, I and a few others kind of suspected that there was some international involvement of some kind, but we didn't really know the details. And now I guess we're getting a few of the details in terms of both the ISIS claim, but also more details about, you know, the attackers potentially having traveled to Syria and things
Amar, if I can just jump in here, one thing which I want to just have you explain for us a little bit more is initially the group that the government first pointed to, National Tawfiq Jamaath, right, is a Sri Lankan Islamist group. Tell us more about them.
Yeah, I mean, very little is actually known about them. They're part of the broader kind of umbrella group of Tawheed Jamaat in Sri Lanka. There's a few of the there's a few different organizations under that name. So there's the Sri Lankan Tawheed Jamaat, there's the National Tawheed Jamaat, and so on. The National Tawheed Jamaat, which is the group blamed for this current attack, is an offshoot of the broader Sri Lankan Tawheed Jamaat and a breakaway group, I guess, based on probably some internal feuding, which we don't know much about yet. And there's an assumption, at least from some of the contacts in Sri Lanka that I've been talking with, that the National Tawheed Jamaat broke away from the broader SLTJ before this attack happened. We also don't know whether the individuals involved in this attack were breakaways themselves from the National Tawheed Jamaat and actually had more contact with Syria and ISIS fighters and things like that. Mm. So my kind of assumption, and there's no evidence of this yet, but my kind of assumption is that these are kind of former members of some of these organizations who formed alliances either with external operations recruiters that were members of the Islamic State and carried out attacks fairly independently, which is what we've seen, for example, in the Bangladesh attacks at the bakery, and a few other South Asian plots like this as well, where it's often been individuals who were previously part of extremist organizations locally who have then allied themselves with these kind of broader transnational international terrorist groups.
Well, Zachary Abuza, I mean, the scale of the attack continues to just stun, right? Because at least 7 suicide bombers all on the same day, they had the equipment, they had the explosives, they had a plan as well. So, it does seem to carry all the hallmarks of a sophisticated operation that a group like ISIS could pull off. I mean, do we have a sense? Can we possibly have a sense in terms of how long something like this had been in the works?
This has been in the works for quite some time. I know the government wants to come out and attribute it, the attack, as retaliation to the mosque attacks in New Zealand last month. But this has been building for far longer than the past month. Back in January, Sri Lankan authorities discovered 100 kilograms of military-grade explosives in the northeast of the country. And while some wanted to kind of attribute that to remnants of the Tamil Tigers regrouping, it was very clear that this was part of a new phenomenon in the country and tied to the growing kind of radical Salafi community there.
So could this have been avoided if the Sri Lankan government had been more proactive, had been there'd been less internecine conflict between members of the government. I mean, I'm still trying to bridge this gap here in understanding as to if there was all this intelligence, and now you're telling us that explosives were found as early as January, and yet there are more than 320 people dead there now.
Sri Lanka has actually quite good intelligence, human intelligence. Any country that has come out of a long-standing civil war tends to do so. And what's really interesting in the case of Sri Lanka is that much of, you know, they had a sizable contingent within their intelligence community made up of Muslim Tamils. Back in 1990, the Tamil Tigers had expelled over 100,000 Muslims from their territory that they controlled. And, you know, many of the Muslim Tamils, you know, were very much part of the Sri Lankan society, recruited into the security services because they spoke fluent Tamil. So I think there was very clear and very good intelligence on this. But intelligence is worthless if politicians don't act on it. You know, this is a lesson for any society, whether the United States or the UK or Sri Lanka, you know, wherever. You cannot make national security a partisan issue, and it really has been the case in Sri Lanka since you've had this complete stasis in politics since October last year.
Right. So Omar, explain to us a little bit more about what Zachary just said about how this has become, up until Sunday, a partisan issue. What is he talking about?
Well, I mean, there's as your previous guest mentioned, I mean, there's an ongoing kind of feud, constitutional crisis between the prime minister and the president. And going into election season now, I mean, there's continued issues between different, you know, political entities that want to hold on to power in Sri Lanka. There's the former Rajapaksa family, including the former defense minister, Gotabaya Rajapaksa, who wants to run for office. And there's going to be kind of continued push and pull, I guess, around this issue of terrorism and whose fault this is and who's soft on terrorism and things like that. I do think when the intelligence came in April or something like that, it was probably received a bit differently by those in power, because there's a kind of ongoing culture of anti-Muslim violence in the country. There hasn't really been any attacks on Christians. There hasn't been plots of this nature, suicide bombs going off in hotels and things like that, for at least since the middle of the war. So I'm kind of almost giving the benefit of the doubt to those that received this intel to basically say, maybe told themselves that this was not a credible threat, because they, you know, we just haven't seen anything like this with these particular targets. The idea of that suicide bombs would go off in hotels and churches targeting Christians, given the context of Sri Lanka and the ethnic relations in Sri Lanka, would have probably been received with a bit of skepticism, I think. And so that might at least partly explain why the memo didn't go to the right people at the right time to kind of act on it. Again, that's just me speculating, but given the kind of context of the country, I wouldn't be surprised.
Well, I want to play a little bit more sound here. This is Hemasiri Fernando, chief of staff to the Sri Lankan president, speaking to NBC News' Bill Neely just yesterday.
Why weren't the churches protected if you had a warning?
Well, how many churches to be protected? But we informed. We informed that there is we never expected an attack of this magnitude.
Zachary Abuza, respond to that. I mean, he was acknowledging that they were informed, but they just didn't expect that it could be something of this magnitude. Is that a gap in the imagination here of people who are in charge of national security of a country? And what lessons are other nations to learn from this?
Yeah, it's a hard one for any security force, because you're going, you know, they have to defend an infinite number of soft targets. The bombings took place in churches in three different cities, as well as the hotels in Colombo. So that does spread security forces thin. But very clearly, because of the partisan, you know, bickering in the country, you really saw a failure of the government to act on this intelligence. And I'd like to pick up on a point that Amaranth made about this. You know, this organization that has been blamed for this really gets started in 2014, 2015 as a response to anti-Muslim pogroms by very conservative, ultra-nationalist Buddhist and Sinhalese organizations that begin to start these sectarian conflicts. And you have to understand there is a direct link to these groups, these radical groups, to what we saw in Myanmar with Wiratu and the 969 movement. You know, a shared Pali language, Theravada Buddhism has always lent itself to these exchanges. And these groups really modeled themselves on the radical groups that began to target the Rohingyas in Myanmar. Mm. And so groups like the NTJ emerge in order to defend the interests of the Muslim community and protect them. Because, you know, from 2014 through 2018, the Sri Lankan security forces at best did not come in to defend the Muslim community, and at worst really turned a blind eye to these pogroms against them. And that's how all of these radical groups really get started, is coming to the defense of their religion, what they consider to be a defense of jihad. Right. What's interesting is then how do they make the next leap from kind of going after Buddhist targets to then focusing on a larger, more radical agenda?
Yeah. Amar, is that so pick up on the thought that Zachary Abuza just left us with, that how do they make the leap? I mean, it sounds as if that we have a situation in Sri Lanka and other nations, as Zachary Abuza was talking about, that is ripe for accepting the involvement of ISIS, and that's potentially how they make that leap.
Yeah. No, a lot of these organizations and the way the Muslim, you know, the way Muslim politics works in Sri Lanka as well is that they have very much tried to enter politics, that very much tried to, engage with the broader political system. Unlike, for example, many of the local Tamil activists have always criticized, for example, different political parties in Sri Lanka, basically saying, you know, you're this is just a waste of time, that you're never going to break through the structure of the Sinhala Buddhist kind of elite that functions in Sri Lanka, that you're never really going to have a say, your people are never really going to get any real self-determination or minority rights. Whereas the Muslims have always very much tried to engage with the political system. And I think a lot of these groups also, in addition to responding to anti-Muslim violence, have also responded to other Muslim political leaders to basically say, we're not like these guys. They're wasting their time with politics and trying to engage with the mainstream. I think we need to do a different kind of activism. And that's how a lot of these tiny groups popped up. The move to violence, I think, it's difficult to say exactly what moved to violence, but if we do want to say, for example, that these guys are returnees from Syria or that they've been communicating with the Islamic State in some way, I think it adds another dynamic to it, in that these guys have probably come back and formed sleeper cells for some time. There have been rumors of sleeper cells in Sri Lanka going back to at least 2015 that I can remember. And so who knows if those are the same returnees or if there are different kinds of returnees involved here. But I think that's the broader dynamic of trying to understand whether these guys are actually returnees from Sri Lanka and engaging in that kind of context where which would make sense with the caliber of the attack we saw.
Well, you know, before we take a quick break here, I want to get to one call. Maurice is calling from Montreal, Canada. Maurice, you're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Go ahead.
I would just love to share with all of your listeners my experience of Sri Lanka, because I feel it may be a little different than the average Canadian or American or North American. I live in Montreal in Canada. I am married to a Sri Lankan man, and we run a fair trade organic business here in Canada. So I've visited Sri Lanka with my daughters to see their grandparents, to see our producers a number of times. I believe it's 8 times now. My experience of Sri Lanka and the Sinhalese Buddhists, the Catholics, the Tamils, the Muslims, it's quite different from what we hear on the news and, in my opinion, what are a lot of propagandists here in the West. The country is beautiful. It is not divided. People are living peacefully. It's resilient. And it's not what we hear over here. A lot of the time, unfortunately, the international community has meddled in Sri Lanka, which is not surprising since they do have a history of hundreds of years of divide and rule politics, caused by international, governments. And it's no different today. In my opinion, these terrorist attacks in other countries are often aided and abetted by the international community. There's a lot of evidence of funding, of arming of terrorist groups all over the world. And a lot of the time it's proxy warfare. My message to Sri Lankan people and to the world would be not to fall prey to this kind of divide and rule politics. We've seen it before many times.
Yeah. Well, Maurice, we've got to take a quick break here. And thank you so much for your call. That's Maurice calling us from Montreal. We're talking about the latest about what we know regarding the terrible coordinated terrorist attacks in Sri Lanka that happened on Easter Sunday. The Islamic State is now claiming responsibility. According to the Associated Press, the Islamic State is now claiming to have identified the attackers as well. They put out a fuller statement on their news agency on Tuesday, detailing where each attacker was allegedly deployed. So what's your question about what the Islamic State's involvement in the Sri Lankan attack means for the rest of the international community as well? We'll be right back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about the latest, about what we know regarding the coordinated terrorist attacks on Sunday in Sri Lanka. I'm joined today by Amarnath Amarasingham. He's with us from Toronto, Canada, joining us via Skype. He's a senior research fellow at the Institute for Strategic Dialogue. He's Sri Lankan and an expert both in Sri Lankan politics and international extremist groups. Zachary Abuza joins us as well. He's with us from Washington, professor of national security strategy at the National War College and an expert on terrorism, insurgencies, democratization, and more in both Southeast and South Asia as well. And let's listen here to what Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said yesterday regarding the Sri Lankan attacks. He said they are, quote, America's fight too.
What was supposed to be a joyful Easter Sunday was marred by a horrific wave of Islamic radical terror bloodshed. It's heartbreaking that a country which has strived so hard for peace in recent years has been targeted by these terrorists.
That's the Secretary of State yesterday speaking about the Sri Lankan attacks. Let's go back to the phone. Let's go to Matthew, who's calling from Morristown, Vermont. Matthew, you're on the air.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. You know, now that apparently we know that this is an ISIS-coordinated attack in a relatively small island in Southeast Asia, my question and comment is, how concerned should we be that this is a wider threat to the Southeast Asian geographical area or the world itself?
Yeah.
And I'll take my answer.
Right. South Asia or the world itself. Matthew, thank you for your call. Zachary Abuza, I mean, this is one of the big urgent questions now, because for quite some time we've been seeing rather simplistic headlines about ISIS being, you know, pushed out of Syria. But clearly their devastating power or influence hasn't necessarily been stamped out globally.
Yeah, the statements that ISIS has been defeated are dangerously premature. Even before the loss of their caliphate in Syria, the organization had really shifted to a global insurgency model and tried to find new fronts. We saw it in 2017 in Southeast Asia with a takeover of the city of Marawi in the southern Philippines. We've seen more pro-IS attacks in Indonesia and the Surabaya bombings of 2018. So this is a global phenomenon, and we have to understand that IS is going to try to graft onto these local groups, such as we saw with the NTJ. One of the key hallmarks, you know, in my opinion, differences between Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State is Al-Qaeda always tried to micromanage attacks. Islamic State is very happy to let local groups act They will encourage them, they will support them, and then take credit for those attacks.
Amar, do you see that being a primary difference between Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State? Because I was just going to ask if this is a familiar story regarding the, you know, the many years of Al-Qaeda's activity.
No, I mean, Zachary is absolutely right. I think from the very beginning, ISIS is, even the way you join ISIS and the way you plot attacks on their behalf has been a bit of a kitchen sink approach. Like they'll take anybody, they'll accept anybody. And there have been some issues, particularly in places like the Philippines and Bangladesh and other areas where there's been some evidence that local groups have provided or given allegiance to ISIS, but it's some of it's been kind of a secret allegiance. They've never been public about it. And so a lot of these local organizations seem to be in constant communication with kind of external operations people with the Islamic State. I think they're often dismissed as just local jihadist groups or conservative Muslim groups that are acting locally. The other thing is, of course, the media apparatus of the Islamic State. Even with this attack, even with all of the media operatives that have been arrested by the YPG, the Kurdish forces in Syria, as well as the ones that have been killed in the last few battles, just in the last 3 hours, ISIS has put out three different claims of the Sri Lankan attack. So one of them has been an immediate claim and then a longer description of the attackers. And now it just released a bunch of photos of the attackers. And so even with the kind of what's happening in Syria and the takedown of this apparatus, they're still functioning quite robustly as they – maybe not as they were at their peak, but it's still quite remarkable.
So then what does that tell us about how effective or what the most effective path towards fighting ISIS then could be right or should be right now for the international community?
I mean, I think we should recognize that a lot of these local groups also want to kind of brand themselves internationally, right? And I think that's often been lost, I think, by local security apparatus because it's not so much that these local organizations have local grievances, but sometimes those local grievances are become very quickly part of global strategies, and they get a lot of cachet by, you know, saying that they're affiliated with Al-Qaeda or affiliated with ISIS. And I think we'll see different local organizations across the Middle East and South Asia and likely Southeast Asia competing, for example, competing for the attention of some of these organizations and branding themselves as such. And so that I think changes the dynamic or changes the way that security forces should approach them and deal with them.
Well, let's go back to the phones. Daniel is calling from Edmond, Oklahoma. Daniel, you're on the air.
Hi. I have a question. If anybody's thought that maybe ISIS is claiming responsibility for something that they actually had no hand in, maybe for empowerment reasons or to help with recruiting in the region, and maybe law enforcement should perhaps focus on splinter cells and maybe not the wide-ranging ISIS.
Well, Daniel, thank you for your question. Zachary Abuza, how would you respond to him?
Again, the point I made before, that the Islamic State has always used different groups and taken claim for their attacks. They're very happy to do so. And that's in very different modus operandi than Al-Qaeda. I think we are going to see more of these groups, especially as the Islamic State has lost the caliphate. They've got to come up with a new strategic model to make themselves relevant. And if they can tie into local grievances and smaller groups that other, you know, fringe groups or those that had a very clear focus on the near enemy of very parochial agenda might have every reason, as Amaranth said, to start to rebrand themselves for this global insurgency.
Now, Amaranth, you've studied international extremist groups extensively. Am I right in saying that you've also interviewed jihadis as well? You've talked to them directly?
Yeah, I talked to quite a few fighters in Syria and Iraq during the conflict.
Okay, and so, I mean, what did you learn from speaking to them that could help shed light on how we should understand what happened in Sri Lanka?
Well, I mean, for what's relevant here, I think, I used to talk to a lot of the fighters as some of these major cities were being lost. And so, like, when Dabiq fell or when Mosul fell, I used to message them and say, you know, what do you think of this loss and how are you you guys going to respond? And they would always respond with this kind of stuff, right? Oh, we've placed sleeper cells across the world. You know, you will see where we pop up and how these things are going to fly. And you know, just because we lost territory, we were expecting to lose territory. The West was never going to allow something like the caliphate to exist long term. So, of course, we you know, preemptively realized that we would lose the territory and things like that. And of course, a lot of it at the time sounded just like boasting or rationalization for defeat. But the way things have played out over time, I think there is something to be said of these sleeper cells. And a lot of captured ISIS fighters in the last few months in Syria have also pointed out that a vast network of kind of sleeper cells have been placed in places like Europe and the Middle East and South Asia. And so we might actually start to see some of these guys be activated, so to speak, to respond to either local grievances or whatever that might be. And just one thing about the kind of ISIS claim, to go to your caller's question, the way ISIS claims have worked, it have always been quite legitimate. I think they in most of these attacks, when ISIS does claim something, we've eventually found some sort of linkage, either communication between some external operations person and the person and the people carrying out the attack. One of the only exceptions to this was, of course, the Las Vegas attack, where ISIS claimed it, then. We found absolutely nothing to kind of link that attack. But I think for the most part that we've eventually found some sort of linkages. And so I think it's just an object of how long the investigation will be carried out to see to kind of unearth some of that.
Right. So, Zachary Abuza, let me turn back to you on something. Amarnath just talked about how, you know, we might be seeing people or sleeper cells being activated in various places around the world, maybe soon, sometime soon here. I want to just bring that together with the fact that in the Sri Lankan attacks, once again, underscore that there was fairly detailed intelligence that was shared with the Sri Lankan government. So does that give, in a sense, should that give us confidence that we have intelligence about these sleeper cells, what could potentially happen? I mean, how do we figure out what we know and if we know enough?
Impossible question to answer, really.
Okay.
You know, the security forces around the world really do need to step up cooperation. This is a transnational threat. No country is going to solve this problem on their own. The problem is breaking down barriers within bureaucracies, the willingness to share intelligence while protecting sources and methods is always a hard one. And we have this problem with our closest allies. And so, you know, dealing with countries that you might have some concerns with or you don't know where they stand on some of the other geopolitical issues is never easy. But it has to be done because this really is a transnational threat. Islamic State's model is based on kind of harnessing these small local groups that we really just don't have the bandwidth to always study. And so we really have to rely on the partnership and cooperation of partners and allies.
Well, let's hear a little bit more from Sri Lankans based in the United States. This is Danitha Mimanog in New York City. Danitha told the Associated Press yesterday that different religions and ethnic communities in Sri Lanka have gotten along well since the end of the civil war about a decade ago.
For the past 10 years, we didn't have any problem. We were living in peace with Muslims, Christians, Sinhalese, Buddhists, and all the nationalities. Now, this is something to do with Muslim terrorist group which have been formed recently. So because of that, we are really shocked and we are surprised. We never accepted a thing like this.
Let's go back to the phones. Let's go to Nicole, who's calling from Charleston, South Carolina. Nicole, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my question. I was wondering, because I've been hearing, I'm a Sri Lankan, American Sri Lankan.
Nicole, are you still there?
I have a lot of family who, yes, hello?
Yeah, go ahead, Nicole.
Okay, sorry. I have a lot of family who were living near the affected areas, although, you know, they're safe now, so. But my question was, I wonder if anyone can speak to the potential unrest that this might cause among the local communities. I was reading a New York Times article about how they observed some, you know, just young men in Negombo, which where I'm originally from, you know, going looking for Muslims. And I know that this is something that's happened in the past where, you know, people have tried to take sort of the law into their own hands. I wonder if anyone can speak to how likely that would, you know, how likely is that to happen?
Yeah, Nicole, thank you so much for your call. Amarnath, let me turn back to you on that, because just to piggyback on Nicole's question, once again, we should just remind ourselves that Sri Lanka had experienced, what, a decade of peace after so much unrest. Is that at risk now?
I mean, I guess I would answer that two ways. I mean, the decade of peace really depends on who you ask. If you ask the Muslim community, for example, in 2013, who had their businesses burned to the ground and mosques kind of destroyed and forced to move into non-Sinhalese areas, or if you ask the Tamil community, who've continue to experience kind of detaining and torture and things like that, I think they would have a very different answer in terms of stability and peace. But I mean, to the broader question, I think the government, it really depends on the government response to this attack. And I think for the time being, quite shockingly, actually, just from knowing the country, they've dealt with it pretty well. They've the kind of crackdown on the social media or the blocking of social media for the time being was a very interesting response, because they realized that particularly in 2018 and 2013, a lot of the anti-Muslim hate and hate speech and conspiracy theorizing about Muslim takeover of the country all started on you know, Facebook pages and WhatsApp groups. And so they, I think the blocking of that for the time being was interesting to say, we're not going to try to, you know, have people use the current attack to launch any more anti-Muslim violence on the streets. I do think we're likely to see some anti-Muslim violence on the streets in the east and likely in Colombo and Negombo. But I think it really depends how the government responds. Mm. And so far, they've been responding fairly well.
Well, Zachary Abuza, we've got just about a minute left to go. Your final thought on this?
Yeah, I think it's absolutely essential that the government cracks down and prevents any Buddhist or Christian vigilantism towards the Muslim community. Again, that is largely how this group got their start in 2014, 2015, in response to attacks on the Muslim community. You cannot give them justifications to wage these defensive jihads, which kind of broaden their appeal to the Muslim community. So it's really important to stop this vigilantism.
Well, Zachary Abuza, professor of national security strategy at the National War College and an expert on terrorism, insurgencies, democratization, and more in both Southeast and South Asia as well. Author of numerous books, including Forging Peace in Southeast Asia. Zachary Abuza, thank you so much for joining us today.
What an honor to be here. Thank you.
And Amarnath Amarasingham, joining us today from Toronto, Canada, senior research fellow at the Institute for Strategic Dialogue, Sri Lankan and an expert both in Sri Lankan politics and international extremist groups, author of Pain, Pride and Politics, Sri Lankan Tamil Activism in Canada. Amarnath, it's been a great pleasure to have you as well. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.